My name is Clint Hodges. I'm an alcoholic. Thank you very much, and thank Ted. Ted is just ahead, and he always gives me his current little disc for birthdays, and so he just turned 40, and he gave me his 39th, and I'm very grateful for that. That was my last birthday. And I'm grateful to be here. I'm absolutely delighted to be here and to be here with you. It's kind of odd. I have what was read here by Jeff is a trigger into something that is interesting to me when we're talking about the sixth and seventh step. We're asked on the prior page, 75, to, when we finished our inventory, go home and think about the effect of that and what we've done and look over the inventory and ask ourselves if we're ready to move on. And at the top of the next page, for the very first time, we're asked by the text to engage intuitive thought. He says, if we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step six. And this idea of intuitive thought is extraordinarily important because we all know that our mind, sober, drunk, but particularly dangerous sober, have odd little lapses. We just kind of get way off track. We wander out there in the far country. I like to think that I'm all lined up with God's will, and way out here. Or I hover on increasingly wider swings around all of that. My instincts, as they say, for sex and survival and society just carry me all over the place. And so that I'm going to talk about step six is very important because without some arrangement for intuitive thought, meaning a thought that doesn't really process through my brain but is just available to me, is an important part of the drill and is what we're moving toward. And I'm really glad to be here talking about it, and I'm glad to be here to have an opportunity to hear what is being said in the room. And I want to thank Bob and his crew for putting on this remarkable event. First time, I don't know of any other event that's ever been put on like this one where people speak solely on the steps. And I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad you're here. And Jeff picked us up at the airport, and I was glad to see him again. We've had some laughs over the years, and I really appreciate that he came up and hunted us down and found us in the baggage department where we hooked up and drove down here. It doesn't take him long to come down from the airport, about 25 minutes, and we were here. That 85, 86 miles an hour. It was a nice trip. I enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Thank you so much. What else is there? Joe, there's a note here. I don't know who was supposed to read it. Joe is 111 today. Is that right? Is there a Joe? Can you raise your 111? Can you raise your hand? I'm not going to ask you to stand up, Joe, but... I'm sorry. It says Joe is ill today. Well, hell, no wonder. Thought he'd be here. Well, okay. Oh, I'm so cute. It wasn't lost on me that Sandy had 73 pages out of the big book to work from in that wonderful talk he gave last night. 73 pages. Angie had 13 and made good use of it. Ralph had 17 and gave a wonderful talk. Thank you very much. Clancy, tonight. history, traditions, and primary... Well, he has the whole book and the entire Library of Congress to work from. Sharon has 7 pages coming up this afternoon, and I know she'll do very well with that. And tomorrow, Tom is going to have at least 19 pages out of the big book on 10, 11, and 12, and the Bible and the Book of Mormon, anywhere he wants to go with it. He can have it all. And I get 14 lines. What the hell is that? Well, so I'm going to have to make up a lot of crap here. I think you know that. There's an interesting idea. I had my first drink when I was 16. And I remember where I was. I was in a Quonset hut on an Air Force base in North Africa, where my dad was working for the government, and I was in high school, 16 years old. And I remember that feeling of peace, that feeling of where has this been, that feeling of God, I wondered why my dad drank like that, and now I know. I wonder if you would take a minute and think about, not the first, but the first drink. That one, where everything changed for you, that drink is huge. Our lives turned that day and have never been the same since. And it doesn't say this in the big book, that first drink and its remarkable relief and sense of safety was... created by alcohol, but we've all assumed that it was, that the booze had the kind of power it would need to give us that remarkable feeling. And somebody has been doing some work on this question on alcoholism, a guy that is a very, very well-educated guy, a Nobel laureate out of Denmark, done some fascinating work and published some books. And I listened to him talk. He thinks that booze isn't as powerful as all of that. He thinks that the alcohol, the first time that effect of alcohol simply parted the clouds, so that we could see who we are. Simply parted the clouds so that we could get a glimpse of our own divinity, our own greatness, our own sense of connection with the universe and with God. And it didn't ever work quite that well again, and then eventually it stopped working, but we are seekers, as has been said here today. We are seekers, and we want very much to be finders. All we have to do really is be seekers, and we are finders, but we want very much to have that. And so we gave our lives for it. We gave up everything for that. And 13 years later, I'm living in a shed and headed towards Skid Row in Glendale. I hadn't planned it, but I'm still trying to get the glimpse that I got when I was 16, and I never got it again. And I had given up all of that, and all I wanted was oblivion. The clouds weren't parting anymore. In fact, there was so much crap in my life and so much stuff that I had pulled in on by way of hatred and guilt and shame and a knowing that I was going to burn forever, that all I wanted was oblivion. And sometimes I got it and sometimes I didn't. And I surrendered at the Alano Club of Glendale on the 14th of August, 1966, just because that guy said, "You're going to drink no matter what." And I knew he was right. I knew he was right. I knew it was all over. I didn't intend to surrender that day. I didn't surrender to God or to AA. AA, I just surrendered to my own terrible failure and knew I would be on Skid Row in 3 weeks. And I had no idea that it was the last, that I wouldn't drink again. I didn't quit. We don't quit. We don't quit. But I had a lot of clouds. A lot of clouds. And I fought my way through them as best I could. And when I was about 23 years sober and had gone to law school, I thought I was something, and I thought I could make it on my own, and I thought that all of this other business was largely behind me, and I would live with what they call the clouds, with my defects, with the broken hearts, with my terrible failure with the women, with my terrible failure with any relationship, and somehow make my way through the world. I'd given up on all of it, really. I was looking for something, and I had no idea what it was. And because I was doing my own program after all of those years, because I had left any real pretense of living a spiritual life, I got lucky in a very nasty way. I lost everything. I lost everything except my sobriety. And so I didn't get to what we're going to talk about today until I was into my 24th year of sobriety. And I have 39 years of sobriety. And so the last 15 years has been the very sweetest of all. It has been the very sweetest of all. It's been remarkable because there's been a peace of mind because the clouds do part. And we do get a glimpse of what we need most of all. And step 6 and 7 is a good way to talk about that. We come to step 5 and we do that sharing of our inventory. And the language of the text in that regard is kind of interesting to back up just a little bit, because he says, finally, he tells us he's going to give us the reason we've even done an inventory. After the inventory is over, having made our personal inventory, what shall we do about it? We've been trying to get a new attitude, a new relationship with our Creator, and to discover the obstacles in our path. As Ralph explained so beautifully this morning, we have admitted certain defects. We have ascertained in a rough way what the trouble is. We put our finger on the weak items in our personal inventory. And then this amazing sentence, Bill writes tight. And he says amazing things in really short sentences. And he says this. And by the way, I like that. Our troubles are of our own making. That idea that no one has to change for me to get free. Because it plagued me terribly. I always wanted people to change. I wanted dead people to change. I wanted them gone. And as long as I held on to that old idea, I was in a lot of trouble. Here's what he says about that idea and others like it. He says, now these are about to be cast out. What? These defects of character are about to be cast out? Oh, I don't think so. That must be for the better class of alcoholics. That must be for the people that really care. Really care. By the way, it also says that those of us belonging to a religious denomination must, of course, and will want to go to the proper appointed authority to take our inventory. And I've had people tell me that they were going to go to a priest or somebody for that fifth step experience, and I think they should do that. And I tell them, right after we do step 5, I want you to make an appointment to go talk to that priest. They don't very often do that. I don't know of anybody that's ever done that. So if we can answer to our satisfaction that we're ready to move on, if our intuitive thought on the matter tells us, yes, I'm a little bit tired of all of this. Yes, I want to go on to the next step. I don't believe that God can remove these defects of character. I saw them in step 4, and I saw them in step 5. and I have carried them a long, long time. And I have seen the futility of them. I mean, I knew my mother didn't love me. And I knew that because she had another baby when I was the apple of her eye. Her crime was getting pregnant again and actually having the baby. And worse than that, to bring it home. Oh, she asked if it was fine if she had another baby. I went, ooh. I had no idea that the last of the loving with me and my mom was done. I had no idea this baby would be set up in some kind of a princess kingdom in another bedroom in this shack we lived in Billings. I had no idea she'd spend her energy and time there. Lavish that baby. So I would go in there and encourage that little infant to move out. Thump her on the head. I didn't want her in the house. And of course my mom knew something was weird, and she saw me doing that, and she grabbed me in her terror and fear and revulsion and anger and threw me out the door of the little room, little bedroom. Threw me right out the door. Before I hit the floor or the wall or whatever I hit out there, I knew she didn't love me. I knew it had all been a betrayal. I knew that her words meant nothing. She never had loved me. Not only did she not love me now, she never had loved me. I knew I couldn't trust her. I knew that. And I didn't know I knew it. But I lumped her in with my grandma, didn't trust either one of them. And we went to war. And I was 14 when my mom died, and I stood at her grave in Billings, Montana, at the low-rent part of that cemetery. And I remember my thought, you don't love me, I don't love you. I always ask for the music to come up about this time. Are you done with that? Faxing in court cards. That's nice. I'm glad. So there's an old idea. You can't trust women is what it comes down to. And I love women and I'm intrigued by women. And I'm sorry I can't trust them. And I'll go as long as it seems to be working out. But if I were to tell the truth in those days and during the early part of my sobriety, I would have said, you know, I didn't get the love I needed when I was a kid. I know you love me. And maybe someday I'll feel that I have gotten the love I need and I can give some to you. And I'll pretend to give you some now. But I can't really love you. I can't do that. Because I can't trust you. And I know one of these days you're going to bust me up good. Nobody would have stuck around long with that little sermon. And I didn't say it, but it would have been the truth. And so they stuck around a little bit longer. Or I got afraid and left them. And I never could be in a relationship. I was more in arrangements than relationships. There's a difference. A difference. Arrangement is a contractual thing, but you do this, I'll do that. But a relationship is on sacred ground, and it's different, and I didn't know that. You've never had a relationship, you don't know the difference. Just up a little higher. So we have a situation here where we are filled with these old ideas. Wilson says we can't hang on to them. We have to let go absolutely. Many of us tried to hang on to our old ideas. And we hang on particularly to the ones that we don't recognize as old ideas. They don't seem like old ideas. They just seem like that's the way it is. Gee, you can't trust women. Well, huh. Do what you can. And so I grew up like that. And drinking gave me a lot of relief about that, an awful lot of relief. And then I do this inventory, and then I read it to another human being, and then I have to answer the question, am I ready to move on? Am I willing, really willing? And that means gladly ready, willing to move on. If we can answer to our satisfaction, then we look at step six. We have emphasized willingness as being indispensable. I thought willingness meant gun to the head time. It does not. It means gladly ready, gladly ready. Am I now ready to let God remove from me all the things that I have admitted are objectionable? That I have admitted by seeing it all laid out in a four-step, in a three-column four-step, am I willing to see that my conduct, my actions, my life, these defects as they show up in my life, as Ralph said so well, are objectionable? Oh, yeah. Yeah. And that's all I have to know, is that I don't approve of it. I don't approve of it. It's not like society doesn't approve of it. Of course they don't. But that's not the issue. The issue is whether I can live with it. Whether I can live with it. And then the amazing thing is, we get a couple of more questions. Can he now take them all, every one? Which means, do I have a God with enough horsepower to take them? Or am I still working with that little low-bore, hateful God that I had when I got here? Am I still working with a God that can't touch that with a 10-foot pole? It's beyond me. I can't get rid of those defects. And I have tried. And I know you have tried. Because we want to be good people. We want to be virtuous. And we think we have to get rid of them on our own. We think before we can really get anything going with God or our fellows, we have to pretty much be free of defects, and we work on them. Which is just sad, isn't it? I mean, God, we can't touch him. We can't touch him. You work on your defects. I got good defects when I worked on them. I polished those puppies up, and man, I never got to be a good liar, but I thought I was a good liar. And I practiced that a lot. And deception and infidelity and all of that stuff. Always had to have somebody in the wings because I knew I couldn't trust her. Couldn't trust her. Am I willing to let that go? Am I willing to let what feels like a virtue, like guilt, go? Or am I going to just pound myself? A guy said an interesting thing to me one day. He said, you have to have some compassion in you for that little piece of you that's never going to get it. What? There's a piece in me that's never going to get it? Yeah, quite apparently. And you're fighting it, and you want to extinguish it, and you want to make it go away. It's not going away. It's going to be there. And the only thing that can possibly calm it down and take the power out of it is to have compassion for it. And I said, well, how the hell do I do that? And he said, you know, when you see the rogue in a meeting that makes you mad, the guy that whatever he's doing, that rogue is you. Have some compassion for that guy. Stop trying to run him out of the meeting. Stop trying to give him a bad time. Stop trying to control him. And just extend to him the same welcome that was extended to you. That was so new to me. That was just astonishing to me. To think that I could have some compassion for that rogue piece of myself just by being careful and loving with a guy that is crazy and whatever he won't do. Shut up, won't take his hat off, he won't stop prowling around the meeting, he won't stop hitting on the newcomer women. That I wanted to hit on. If we cling to something we will not let go, we ask God to help us be willing. The look at this in my life came out of step five, because the task seemed to be not to just listen to that three column inventory. Yeah, I'm furious with my mom. Why? She didn't love me. What do I have to believe that? That's the question. What old idea, what old belief is in play? I've hung on to that one for a long time. And now we're at a point where we have to say, what is the belief that holds that one in place? What pre-logical little boy belief did I come to? Well, I came to the astonishing belief that my mother could not love me. She's my mother. I am of her. And I could believe that she didn't love me. There was always food on the table. There were clothes. There was a roof. My dad was gone a lot and drunk a lot. And she was frightened a lot. And she loved me day in, day out. I can't imagine that I could believe that. I believed it. I believed my grandma didn't love me. I didn't have any doubt that God was disgusted with me. I didn't believe that I had a place in the world. I took an inventory, as I say, 15 years ago, and a thorough inventory, and got to this piece, and I'm writing down my old ideas. It's too late for me. I'm too old. Life has passed me by. Isn't that a beauty? It's too late. I really know it's too late for me. To do what? Whatever. Can't do it. I'm going to turn this old bag of bones over to the care of God. What? What the hell is that? I can't have money. Can't have it. Really? That's interesting. That's interesting. You have money. Well, I mean, I can't have real money. I can't have the kind of money that wealthy people have. Well, are you getting, you have a good credit rating? Yeah, yeah, amazingly. Are you paying your bill? Yeah. Are you providing for the people that you should be? Yes. Is the, by this time long earlier, I had gone to law school and was practicing law. Are you paying the bills attached to your law? Yeah. But you can't have money. Is that the idea? Well, I guess so. I always had a sense of being impoverished. Always had a sense of having to pretend that there was more. There was more. I had an interesting experience not long ago. I wanted a new car. Did I need a new car? No. Did I want a new car? Absolutely. And I was out driving. Linda was fine with it. My wife was fine with it. No problems at all. I had been taught a prayer by this time that was an interesting prayer. And I finally asked it because I was driving all these cars and I didn't like any of them better than the one I was driving. Not one. I mean, I really like my car, but it's not new. It's 3 years old. It'll be four in April. God. And it's a great little car. And I made a mistake. I made the prayer that I had. Then I said, if I go there and get a new car, will you go with me? And the answer came back, no. What? Let me say it again. No, you're on your own. It's not going to be a disaster if you go get a new car, but you're on your own if you go get a new car. So I did. I immediately backed away from that, which just astonishes me that this program has done that kind of thing for me. Makes me willing to be right size. I just find that's astonishing, and I come out of these steps with that. We are in the business of humility at step six. Humbly asked him. But before we can do that, we have to get a couple of questions answered. One is he big enough to do that? Number two is, will he do it for me? Oh, I know he's done it for you, but will he do it for me? I need a yes to both of those questions. And the other one is, am I willing to let all of the character defects or shortcomings or old ideas, whatever they are, am I willing to let them go? Am I willing to let them go? The entire energy of the recovery piece of this trilogy, the recovery legacy, is a different energy. If I want to be of more service, I just hike it up and get into more service. I attend more meetings, I make the coffee, I set up the chairs, I do whatever. I work with guys, whatever. And if I want to get into more fellowship, I go to more meetings, I form friendships, I sponsor people, I do all of that, and you do it by increasing your efforts. But recovery, the base of the triangle, is a different kind of energy. The energy in recovery is more about letting go, which we're not used to doing. It takes a kind of a doing of letting go. And it's always feeling risky when we just let go of the idea that I need a new car. Let go of this, let go of that. Years ago, they told me how there was a time in the United States when live monkeys were very much in demand in laboratories and in zoos and in all kinds of locations. And it's hard to get a live monkey. They go into Africa and they track them down and they trap them. And the monkeys would kill themselves or tear off a leg before they would allow themselves to be trampled and caught and so on. And pickings were bad. And the monkeys that they did catch weren't very good specimens. And they wanted live monkeys that were healthy. And somebody stumbled onto a great idea. They took heavy metal vases with long necks down into the area where the monkeys were, and they'd put them along the trail the monkeys used, and they'd cover all of that up with some whatever leaves or the debris that was there. But the monkeys could smell the sweet meats that were in the vases, and they would stick their hand way down in there, and they would grab a handful of these things. And then they would try to pull their hand out of the metal jar, and they couldn't get it out. And they would drag that heavy metal jar down the trail a little while, and then try to yank and pull it and pull it. And they couldn't get the sweet nuts out of there. And they couldn't open their hand and let them go. And 3 days later, the hunters would come out of camp where they'd been playing cards and go down into the trail and trank these monkeys, and they had all the monkeys they could need because they wouldn't let them go, would not let the sweetmeats go. And how many, we've all done that. How many times have I taken my heavy metal jar down to my sponsor? And we have a talk, and I'm told exactly what to do. And somehow, at the end of the talk, I walk out of there dragging my heavy metal jar with my sweet. I won't let go. I won't let go. And nobody can make me let go, because whatever it is, my ego demands that it stay in my life. And that's the way we want. So, is God powerful enough? Will I let go? If not, I can ask God for willingness. That's not a bad thing to do. I don't ask God for help anymore. It's not like somebody asked me not long ago if I would help them move. And I knew, and he knew, that if I didn't help him move, he could get help from somebody else. And he did. And we all helped him. But if I had not been available, he would have gotten moved. If nobody helped him, he would have gotten it done. He would have gotten it done. And it's not that he couldn't do it. It's just that he wanted help. And so when I ask God for help, I'm kind of without even knowing it, in a place where I'm saying, I think I can jump over this 10-story building, but could you give me kind of a boost at the beginning? And that's the wrong thing. Take me to a place where I am willing to have you remove it. That's the only prayer worth saying here. Take me to a place where I can become willing, gladly ready to have you remove it. Take it away. Root and branch, as they say. In the 12 and 12, it says humility here is the key. Knowing the truth, that's the essence of humbly asking. Humbly asking, the essence is knowing the truth about the matter. Knowing that I can't budget to save my life. I can't get rid of this character defect. I want to have humility, as they call it, a nourishing ingredient in my life. They call it a healer of pain. They call it the move from weakness to strength, because I'm tapping into power, because I'm tapping into power. This willingness is so important, and we hate to do it. You know, we were talking earlier today about selfishness and self-seeking and all the selves. I think the selfishness that really hammers me is the idea that I've had ever since I was a little boy that I have to do it all myself. I must. I've turned it into a virtue. It says in the first part of the book, in Bill's story, we ask God to intercede for us. We go in all things to the Father of Light, who presides over us all. There's nothing that is an inappropriate prayer. There's no part of my life that's an inappropriate request. But I think I have to do it all myself. I was laughing. There was a gal in Reno named Joyce, and as I was going through this, I was up in a conference in Northern California. She told a wonderful story. Joyce told an extraordinary story during her talk. She talked about when she was 10 years sober, she wanted to get over her fear of heights. And she decided to take skydiving lessons. And she did. And she went out there and took these lessons, and the day came eventually when she was certified to do a solo jump. And in the jump zone, the drop zone, was her sponsor and the women she sponsored and a couple of her kids and her husband. And that plane came over, and Joyce came out. She had a bit of bad luck. The chute that she had put together failed to open all the way. Joyce hit the deck a lot harder than she was supposed to hit the deck, and reported to us at that conference up there that she spent the next 18 months of her life learning how to urinate again. And you go, oh, God, Joyce. And you notice that she had limped when she walked, and her face was a little bit off, not disfigured, but... And she, in that 18 months, in the emergency, in the trauma center, in the rehabilitation, her husband left. But she got to be good friends with an ex-husband that was in AA. He would come for lunch, and they'd have lunch in the cafeteria or in her room. And one day he said, you know... I never quite got it when I heard that you were skydiving when you got hurt. He said, what was that all about? And she said, I really wanted to get over my fear of heights. And he kind of laughed a little bit, and she said, what are you laughing at? And he said, all you had to do was humbly ask. And I went, oh my God, there is so much power here that she could have easily taken a position that she wanted to get rid of that fear of heights and ask God to remove it for her, if she really wanted to get rid. But we think we have to do it all ourselves. And so she took her sky. And I have jumped out of a lot of airplanes in my sobriety. figuratively speaking, because I know that I have to, as a good little boy, tie my own shoes, take my own bat, tuck myself into bed. Never mind that other, if you're going to be a good little boy, do it yourself. And I get to Alcoholics Anonymous, and nothing has changed until I come across a goofy little old idea I have, and that is, I am not a good kid until I do it all myself. And there's nothing in the book about that. I've made a virtue out of a defect of character that has got in my way, that has prevented me from doing. Go through the law school deal. It was 4 years of hard work. And I'm glad I did that 4 years of hard work. But it was all about do it yourself. And when I had completed the 4 years, I really thought I was something. I really thought I had achieved something, gone someplace. When I practiced law in those days, doing it the way that my ego said to do it, it was really not a pretty thing. The idea of a law practice, for me, a litigation practice, was you practice your character defects, you call it advocacy, and you send out a bill. And there I was at the height of my spiritual game doing that kind of stuff. One of my clients was a guy that had an interesting old idea. We were ready to go to trial. Billy had a lot of hair, long hair. I told him ever since I took the case, you can't show up in court with all that hair. You really have to cut it back to a more civilized look. Well, why do I have to do that? And I said, because the jury is less likely to think you're telling the truth if you come in there looking like some kind of a guy that's just off the streets. Clean it up. Clean it up. And he really, really did not want to do that. And I saw him again. His hair was still. I said, you really got to do it. Because we can't go to trial with you looking like a rag picker coming over the hill. In a gentle way, I told him that. He said, I really can't. I said, why? He said, because I have badly deformed ears. I thought, well, now we're getting someplace. And if I cut my hair, they will see my ears. I said, well, let me see your ears. We're in my office, and there's a mirror on one wall. And I was shocked when he pulled his hair back, and I could see his ears, because his ears looked like my ears. And I said, those aren't beauties, but I think the jury will forgive you for those ears of yours. And we talked about it for a while, and I said, how'd you get the idea? What the hell happened to you? He said, well, my mom always kidded me because I had big ears. I said, yeah. And then what? He said, well, one day in the third grade, I came running home, and it was I was just going to jump in the kitchen and get a couple of cookies and go back out to play, and when my mom called me, I was going to come back in for dinner. And I went in the kitchen, and she's on the phone with my aunt, and I heard her say, something like, I got to hang up now. Billy just came running in, and little pictures have big ears. He had no idea what that meant, except that he took it personally, and now he's ashamed of his ears, and as soon as he could grow his hair long, he did that. And when he said that, he got it. And we're looking in the mirror, and we're laughing and crying and carrying on. He got a haircut. He got three haircuts. He wasn't really jumping on it, but he... And then we settled the case just to show him how silly he was to cut his hair. No, I'm kidding. We didn't do that. Humility. Humbly ask him. This, they say, is what separates the men from the boys. In the 12 and 12, he gives it a little more attention, gives it a little more time, a little more space. how the hell could this separate the men from the boys? And he finally says it in the 12 and 12. He says, the boys want to set their own agenda. The child in me wants to set my own agenda and live by my objectives. And let's get a Mercedes in here now. And I bought a few of them on that basis. There's another way. To give up limited objectives. To let God set the agenda. To ask for His blessing and the knowledge of His will in what I do. And I want to get at it. Delay is dangerous because, given the strange mental blanks in my life and the goofy needs I have to look bigger than I am, I may do some really silly things, and I have done really silly things, particularly with my money and particularly with relationships and particularly with every part of my body and life. I have done some really silly things sober, some expensive things, some things that humiliated and embarrassed me, things that really I look back on them and I thought, how could I go there? How could I get into that fight with that judge? How could I get into that fight with the client? How could I get into that? How is it that I married that lady? We both knew that was a bad idea. Of course it didn't work. A good friend of mine named Tom Whalen and I were having dinner one night. He said, I was at the end of another relationship. He said, how many have there been now? And I said, I don't know, Tom, I a bunch. He said, well, what's been the common theme throughout every one of them? And I said, they just couldn't be intimate is really what was wrong. He asked me that question three times, and he's raising his voice, and people in the next table are putting their forks down and looking over. And he finally said, you're the central factor in all of this. Shh, Tom, Jesus Christ. Not here, please. And I've never forgotten it. I've never forgotten it. I bring that crap to the table. I bring it. And I select somebody that is a perfect match for that. And it wasn't until I was able, finally and at long last, to surrender, to say whatever, to let that be the... And it was only out of the terrible fear that I walked around in at 23 years of sobriety, knowing that I would be pushing a cart with all my crap in it. I knew that. I had a brother, sober, died in Atlanta, Georgia, doing that. He got in a scuffle and he got in the VA hospital and back out, and he didn't have an apartment, he didn't have anything, but he found another food basket and collected some crap and put in it. And I could find him once in a while if I looked hard enough and he admit he was angry. He was furious. How else can I get my message out? I said, what's the message? He said that our folks did it wrong. I said, well, of course they did it wrong. What about honor thy father and thy mother? What about that? Nah, I'm not going to do that. He said, I know what that means. It means live as if they had done it perfectly. I said, wow, that's pretty interesting. And you have no interest in that. He said, I do have an interest in it, but I got a message. I want the world to know what they did to me. I said, I'm so sorry you do. Why don't you come to Atlanta? No. He had to do it there in Atlanta with my father a few miles up the road. And he got into another fight and died. And we all went back there, my brother and my sister and a couple of distant relatives, and stood around a cemetery in the federal cemetery there where he'd been buried. Air Force veteran. A wasted life, not an alcoholic, but a point to prove. I don't want to prove any more points. I don't want to become an old embittered man. I want to be here with you, and I want to tell you that there is a way. And the way is that we finally and at long last say something like, "My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and to my fellows. Grant me strength, give me power as I go out from here to do your bidding." And that has to be the game for me. And it took me a long time getting there, a long time in sobriety getting there. We have to die before we die. And then death is not a big deal. We must let it all go if we're going to be happy on this earth and effective. Abandon limited objectives. And it really is once in a while, sitting here with you or praying or with my wife, Linda, or having a wonderful time taking somebody else through the steps, once in a while, the clouds part. And that glorious sense of being in the right place at the right time is part of who I am. And there's a divinity in me that connects with the divinity in you and with the divinity of the universe. And that's where it started. I got a glimpse of that and never rested, and I gave up my life for it. And it's come full circle, and I'm here in Alcoholics Anonymous over 39 years, and for today, this day, I'm willing to give up my life for that glimpse again, because it's the sweetest life I've ever known. Thank you.